Today on Vox Talks Economics, is it the state or the limits on the state's power that keeps the peace? Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics, so remember, subscribe and follow us on Instagram as well at Vox Talks Economics. When Thomas Hobbes published his book Leviathan in the 17th century, he was arguing that individuals enter a social contract with the state to maintain order, and that the state has absolute authority over its citizens. Now, the principle that the state's monopoly of institutionalized violence is the thing that keeps the peace is now widely accepted. But is this true, or do the checks and balances on that power actually prevent conflict? Gérard Rolland of the University of California, Berkeley, is one of the authors of a new paper that reevaluates these ideas, and he joins me now. Gérard, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hello, Tim.
Gérard, did I get that right? What did Hobbes believe?
So the idea of Hobbes is that if there was not a state with not only a monopoly of violence, but also concentrating a lot of power, if you didn't have such a state, you know, the Leviathan in the idea of Hobbes, then there would be anarchy and war of all against all. So very often we talk about Hobbesian wars by this concept of war of all against all. The ideas of Hobbes corresponded actually quite a bit to the rise and emergence of absolutist powers in Europe. Mm. And also there's a whole literature on state building, so you can put it there.
To be precise about this, Hobbes was writing just after the English Civil War, which was fought about whether the king had the absolute right to govern his subjects. And he thought that if there wasn't a sovereign that embodied this power, then we would just have perpetual civil wars.
That was indeed his argument. And as I said, he advocated for a very strong concentration of power with the king. But in a way, you know, having some form of state structure is a prerequisite. But you can have strong states and still have forms of civil war or big fights inside the elite. And we kind of put the argument on its head. Once you have very strong concentration of powers, this actually lures challengers to that power. And there can be conditions when the king is very powerful, this will attract other people who will want to take the role of the king. And actually having a strong concentrated power may lead to challenges to that power. And we show in a model that this can be quite general. What is actually more important, which is what we emphasize, is how that power can be limited. We are very much inspired by the latest book by David Stasavage, where he compares pre-modern with modern democracies. And pre-modern democracies, when they existed, this was more scarce. You know, you had big empires that were more like the Hobbesian state. Mm. But when you had pre-modern democracies, they had forms of unanimity. And in a way, this is what our model shows, that if the king has a lot of power to persecute people, then this can actually lead to challenges to his power, because people, knowing that there might be a war, then they want to participate, and they can even, being in a winning coalition, they could seize power. Whereas when you have some form of unanimity rule, this strongly limits the power of the king to persecute, and it also limits the attraction of being in power. So this is something very important. And when we think about unanimity rule today, we look at unanimity rule as something cumbersome, rigid, preventing decisions from being made, etc. But the truth was that you have to look at the counterfactual. In pre-modern democracies, there were indeed these kind of forms of unanimity. But thinking more deeply about it, when we think about the concept of human rights, the inviolability of human rights, it's a way of saying there are decisions that cannot be taken by majority rule. Mm-hmm. People's individual rights, whether it's their freedom, their property rights, etc. These are inviolable rights. This is kind of the application of the unanimity principle that people's rights can be protected. And this is very important in today's world where we are seeing, so for example, Xi Jinping, who you could even argue that this is the model of, you know, the Hobbesian autocrat, where indeed there's monopoly of violence. The Communist Party says that they're doing things more efficiently. There's, you know, no rigidity, et cetera, et cetera. And you see in some countries where democracy is under attack, being in Hungary, Poland, etc. So it's very important to see that this form of unanimity rule, in whether it's in political decisions or by saying that people have rights that cannot be taken away, that these are important protections that also secure civil peace.
Yes, as I understand it, Hobbes believed that all authority descended from the sovereign. This idea of a unanimity rule embodied in a universal human rights modifies this, doesn't it? So that there is a sort of a veto on the sovereign's power.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is indeed what it is about. But on the other hand, I was talking about pre-modern democracy.
Yes.
And you mentioned the English Civil War. What we do see is that, and again, you know, Stasavage's book is very interesting on this, that the emergence of modern democracy with majority rule in England was actually based on, you know, the Glorious Revolution, on a different institutional rule, such as the Treason Act, the Act of Settlement, that created not only independence, but also insulation of the judiciary. So when the House of Lords was actually critical in making decisions to persecute anybody, this was a protection that could prevent any kind of civil war. And we do see that after that, that indeed British institutions started to stabilize and civil peace came along. Mm. And we argue that this is because of separation of powers. This is because of the insulation of judiciary. And that made modern democracy possible. In other words, to have modern democracy with majority rule, you need institutions where human rights are protected. That's number one. But you also need a judicial branch of government that plays a key role in preventing arbitrary decisions or persecutions by the executive. It's no coincidence that today, when you see in Hungary, Poland, or even Israel, attempts to undermine democracy start always by attacking the powers of the judiciary. So by trying to break the independence of the judiciary, one strengthens the power of the executive and therefore also the possibility of abuse of power.
How do dictators grab power and how do they hold on to it? We investigated this question in December 2020 in an episode called How Authoritarians Stay in Power.
Can we take a step back from this, Gerard, and really define what the separation of powers means and your concept of the separation of powers?
Yes, that's a very good question. So we see this in two different ways. The first relates to pre-modern democracies. As I argued, some form of unanimity rule is needed to prevent decisions of persecution and expropriation. The question is such a unanimity rule stable? Can it be stable? And here we build on the example of Venice. Venice, for 500 years, had very peaceful situation, you know, had prosperity, etc. And this is because Venice, in contrast to many other city-states in Italy, for example, which, you know, existed at the same time, Venice had separation of powers in the sense that the executive did not have agenda-setting power over decisions. So the agenda-setting powers lay with what was called the savi grandi. And so Venice had a form of separation of powers where indeed the legislative agenda-setting power was not in the hands of the executive. And in our model, we understand this as preserving unanimity rule. So again, this is only related to unanimity rule. So having separation of powers in the sense that the legislature is independent from the executive can provide stability to the unanimity rule, because people in the legislature will understand that unanimity rule can prevent civil war and they will support it. Whereas the king would prefer, of course, to have absolute dictatorship. So that's yes. Number one. The second concept of separation of powers, which is about modern democracies, is that when societies become independent, cohesive, in the sense of the French sociologist Durkheim, if you have, and then this is where the judiciary is critical, if you have a judiciary branch of government that is not only independent, but what we call insulated, that is where judges specialize, they have a career as judges, they don't become politicians. When mm-hmm. you have those conditions, then you can have a modern democracy. So democracy is much more than majority rule. It's really about having fundamental human rights, and it's having separation of powers. And here in modern democracies, it's really more about the judicial branch of government.
The judicial branch of government in many modern democracies that we see around us is under attack at the moment. What does it take for a judicial branch to be stable?
Well, you know, this is the problem, is that in a democracy, when the judicial branch is under attack, it's not able to defend itself very well. And then in that case, it's really up to the citizens, up to all those who support democracy, to try to defend it. Look at what's happening in Israel. There were hundreds of thousands of people in the street. They understand that the attack on the judiciary is an attack on democracy. Unfortunately, in Hungary and Poland, so far, the autocratic side has been winning, but it's truly a fight for a government. And you're right, the judicial branch cannot defend itself very well when it's under attack.
Your concept of how the peace is kept in a modern democracy relies on the strength of this separation of powers and the fact that this is respected by everyone who could wield power. Does this better describe what's been going on in the, say, the 20th and the 21st century so far, better than a sort of like this Hobbesian view that a strong state is necessary to preserve order?
Well, you know, when you started having strong states, absolutist powers, this led to empires. I mean, I'm talking a bit outside the paper here,
yes.
But this led to empires that were at war with each other. There was strife, you know, inside countries. We've had the emergence of, you know, totalitarianism in Germany, in Soviet Union, in China, etc. So in a way, the more we have technology to support concentration of powers, as we see, for example, today in China, then, you know, this gives a lot of power to the state, a lot of power to abuse. But now coming back to our model, if you follow that, this is not necessarily stable, because this concentration of power is going to be envied by others who will want to, who understand that it can be dangerous for them, and so who also see that it can be attractive if they're in place of the leader. So one thing I maybe would like to add about this, it's not a main idea in our paper, but it is, I think, an important idea, is that when you have a separation of powers, and here again, be it the legislature or the judicial branch of government, there are times when there are emergencies. If you are facing a natural catastrophe or, you know, a war, then it is important to be able to make decisions very fast. And what we show in the paper is that in situations like, let's say, Venice, where there was separation of powers, it could be very well possible to delegate to some person, to delegate powers to deal with the crisis, knowing perfectly well that when the crisis was resolved, then the institutions in place would go back to where they were initially. Whereas in other places, so for example, you know, you could say Florence or even Genova, etc., where there were forms of checks and balances, but when in case of war or emergency, you delegated power to somebody important, there was no guarantee that you would go back to, you know, non-autocratic government after that. So in a way, and we've seen it in the U.S. during World War II, the president was given strong powers. And after World War II, actually, the rule that the president could not have more than two mandates was introduced as also as a way of showing that you need to keep the power of the executive under check.
You look at the modern process of state building, then all constitutions that are written now, they have some kind of recognition of a separation of powers. And we kind of assumed a generation ago that there would be an orderly progress towards a modern democratic settlement in most places. We've seen a retreat from that. For example, in Russia, Vladimir Putin is someone that Hobbes might have recognized as a Leviathan. Does your paper tell us something about what's happening and what's not happening in modern state building?
Our paper goes beyond the modern state building. You said it's assumed normal that there should be separation of powers, but I don't think that this understanding has penetrated deeply among many people.
Yeah.
They still see democracy as simply majority rule, and with majority rule, you can oppress minorities. That's what Orban is doing. But to come back to Putin, indeed, he has completely demolished any kind of early democratic institutions that were established in Russia. And as a consequence, look what's happening now. They invaded Ukraine. And if Russia loses, it's quite clear that Putin is going to be in danger and there will be no civil peace. There will more likely be forms of civil war, which is in line with our model.
And is there a policy solution when we have a constant war of all against all in the Hobbesian sense? Is there anything that can be done to stop that?
Well, I think that the first thing is that we have to be quite clear about what a democracy really means. And I think this idea of the fundamental role of separation of powers to secure internal peace, I think, is something very important. So there's, first of all, a battle of ideas. I think the battle of ideas needs to be won in today's world. You have people who are saying, look, Xi Jinping can do things better than Biden. So there is indeed this battle of ideas, you know, going on. And I think that's really the first step, because you cannot have a stable democracy if you don't have those institutions behind it. So in other words, you cannot establish democracy overnight in a country. You need people to be behind the idea, to support the idea, and you need people to form expectations that it is going to work, and people respect the constitution with separation of powers and are strongly behind it. So there's no silver bullet. There's absolutely no silver bullet. This is something that people have to be convinced of and have to fight for. And once it's there, you want to protect it and stabilize it.
Is it also the case that leaders need to accept that there are limits on their power and they need to do that voluntarily? We've seen threats to that in many countries. Brazil is one that we haven't mentioned so far, where there is a strong constitution that does set out the limits to the leader's power. They're not always very happy with that.
That's right. On the other hand, you know, compared to other countries, political scientists have noted that in a country like Brazil, the powers of the president are very, very strong. So in a country like Chile, for example, the powers of the president are somewhat less strong. And in line with our mode of thinking, this would lead to think that Brazil would be less stable because, I mean, Brazil is a democracy so far, even if under attack. But, you know, even under democracy, when you have too strong powers concentrated in some hands, that can lead to instability. That's one of the major ideas of our paper.
Gerard, it's a fascinating paper, and it is one that is so much more relevant to the times we're living through than maybe we would have thought if it had showed up a decade ago. So very timely, very interesting, very challenging as well. Thank you very much for talking about it today.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you very much.
The paper is called Hobbesian Wars and Separation of Powers. It is discussion paper 17900 at CEPR if you want to find it that way. And the authors are Weijia Li, Gerard Ronon, and Yang Jia.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. We bring you the best new research in economics every week. So subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Next time on Vox Talks, why climate risk stress tests may be giving us a false sense of security.